Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Sod 1 of For the Record program number 738, Turkish Taffy, Part 2. This program is being recorded on April 3rd of the year 2011. This broadcast, like so many others, will be much more understandable, I guess one could say, if the SpitfireList.com website is used. There are books, long article-length descriptions of past programs, and posts of all kinds, a tremendous amount of information to avail oneself of. And increasingly, use of that website is going to be essential to a serious understanding of these broadcasts. Now, the title of the program, Turkish Taffy, is a direct follow-up on For the Record 737. Turkish Taffy, of course, is a type of candy. It is a sweetened confection, and it is used in the title here because it is a metaphor for what we have been told about the political future of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood and perhaps similar organizations in other countries, other Muslim countries, particularly Middle Eastern Muslim countries. And we're being told that the Muslim Brotherhood, which is an Islamic fascist organization for the umpteenth time, it was allied with the Axis in World War II, and then because of its effective murderousness was then utilized at various points by British intelligence, CIA. It spawned the Afghan Mujahideen about in the first Afghan war against the Soviets. It spawned Hamas. It spawned Al-Qaeda. It spawned Palestinian Islamic Jihad. But now we are being told that the Muslim Brotherhood, again, allied with the Axis in World War II, has moderated and that it aspires to a political stance and a political role similar to the Islamists in Turkey. The AK party of Mr. Erdogan, by the way, that's Erdogan, not to be confused with Mr. Erbakan, Erbakkan, his political mentor. Mr. Erdogan's AK party is basically something of a knockoff and an alleged moderation of the Refah Party of Mr. Erbakan. As we looked at last week, and as we're going to review, time permitting, inside two, Mr. Erbakan actually was very closely affiliated not only with the Muslim Brotherhood, but also with Ahmed Huber and the Bank al-Taqwa. Huber himself served as an effective point of operational liaison and ideological commingling, I guess one could say, between the Islamic fascism of the Muslim Brotherhood and European and American fascism as well. Jean-Marie Le Pen of the Front National in France was one of the people that was introduced to Mr. Erbakan by Ahmed Huber, and they found common ground. And we'll review that, time permitting, inside too. We went into that in For the Record 736. In fact, the available evidence suggests that the ostensible moderation of Mr. Erdogan's party is largely illusory. The AK party has very close relations with the Muslim Brotherhood, and although domestically their stance, for example, towards women and other Turkish citizens is more moderate than some Islamists, the flotilla incident, marvelously botched by the Israeli Defense Forces, but the flotilla incident itself, I think, was very significant. We went into that in For the Record as 723, and the flotilla incident was basically a provocation. It was set up by the Turkish government, and it was set up in cooperation with the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Israeli Defense Forces fell right into what was a very predictable trap and took a huge PR beating. But for our purposes here, the playing of the Israel card, so to speak, by the, quote, moderate, unquote, Turkish AK party, again, pretty much a direct knockoff of the Refah party, whose founder Erbakan is part and parcel to the Fascist International, the sort of let-em-eat-Israel or let-em-eat-Jews stance, I think, bodes poorly for the future of the Muslim Brotherhood political landscape in other countries as well, notably Egypt. So when we are told that the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood is moderate and that we should look upon them with the same in the same light as we look upon the Turkish Islamists of the AK party, I think the Turkish taffy, this sweetened confection that is being handed to us, needs to be taken with a grain of salt, so to speak. I do not think that the future is going to work out very nicely. And indeed, as we've seen in past broadcasts in this ongoing analysis, the op-ed pages of the New York Times on successive days in February of this year were graced, if one could use that term, by Tariq Ramadan, the son-in-law of Hassan al-Banna, founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, and a guy named Assam el-Arian, who was a key Egyptian Muslim brother, and both basically lied in their teeth about the history of the Muslim Brotherhood, saying it was peaceful, nonviolent, parliamentarian, etc., except, of course, for their stance toward the Jews. That's simply not true. And as I mentioned in past broadcasts in this analysis, that reminds me of the op-ed columns that were being floated by the Hearst Press in the United States in the run-up to World War II, in which people like Hermann Göring of the Luftwaffe, the Reichsmarshal, people like Rudolf Hess, for many years Hitler's personal deputy, Benito Mussolini, the fascist dictator of Italy, were writing columns assuring Americans that, in fact, the Axis had nothing but peaceful intentions in mind, and that they really did not, the Americans, that is, did not have to worry. I take the assurances about the Muslim Brotherhood in a very similar vein, and indeed, that's why I use the metaphor. I think this is Turkish taffy. This is a deliberately sweetened confection, and it needs to be taken with a grain of salt. Going right to the substance of why I'm skeptical about the moderation of the Muslim Brotherhood, and frankly, very pessimistic about the future of Egypt and the Middle East, in fact, the whole human race. In the April edition of Vanity Fair magazine, there is an article by the apparently terminally ill Christopher Hitchens, and although just a brief editorial note, although I frequently disagree with Christopher Hitchens, he is one of the few real wordsmiths left and a real sophisticate, and I certainly hope that he's able to pull through the very serious esophageal cancer that he is afflicted with at the moment. In the April 2011 edition of Vanity Fair magazine, Christopher Hitchens has his observations on Egypt, and he says, "What I don't see at the revolution," subtitled, "as someone who has witnessed many stages of upheaval, whether in Eastern Europe, Asia, or South Africa, the author puts forth a wary prognosis for the brave Egyptians who thronged Tahrir Square. They likely haven't got the resources to break the chains of tyranny." And one of the points that Christopher Hitchens makes is the following, skipping down: "Neither in exile nor in the country itself is there anybody who even faintly resembles a genuine opposition leader. With the partial exception of the obsessively cited Muslim Brotherhood, the vestigial political parties are emaciated hulks. The strongest single force in the state and the society, the army, is a bloated institution heavily invested in the status quo. As was once said of Prussia, Egypt is not a country that has an army, but an army that has a country. More depressing still, even if there existed a competent alternative government, it is near impossible to imagine what its program might be. The population of Egypt contains millions of poorly educated graduates who cannot find useful employment, and tens of millions of laborers and peasants whose life is a subsistence one. I shall never forget, on my first visit to Cairo, seeing the City of the Dead, that large population of the homeless and indigent which lives among the graves in one of the city's sprawling cemeteries. For centuries, Egypt's rulers have been able to depend on the sheer crushing weight of torpor and inertia to maintain, quote, stability, unquote. I am writing this in the first week of February, and I won't be surprised if the machine, with or without Mubarak, is able to rely again on this dead hand while the exemplary courage and initiative of the citizens of Tahrir Square slowly ebb away." And skipping down, sort of typical of Christopher Hitchens' way with words is this following. I think in many ways this is a hallmark not only of this broadcast, but a lot of times I feel this way about life in general. "Heroism breaks its heart, and idealism its back on the intransigence of the credulous and the mediocre, manipulated by the cynical and the corrupt." Indeed, and there is an awful lot to make people in Egypt easy to manipulate. I'm going to reiterate something from a column that was syndicated by Thomas Friedman of the New York Times. The San Jose Mercury News of February 24th of 2011 headlined this, "Arab World's Transition to Democracy, No Picnic." And in that, Thomas Friedman cites a Middle East Quarterly report in the fall of 2002 about the serious social conditions afflicting the Arab world. We had something of a subjective account of Christopher Hitchens in Egypt. This sort of quantifies and provides a body of statistics to that analysis. Skipping down, a summary of the report in Middle East Quarterly in the fall of 2002 detailed the key evidence. Gross domestic product of the entire Arab world combined, I would add parenthetically, that's 300 million plus people in 22 countries, continuing, was less than that of Spain. Per capita expenditure on education in Arab countries dropped from 20% of that in industrialized countries in 1980 to 10% in the mid-1990s. In terms of the number of scientific papers per unit of population, the average output of the Arab world per million inhabitants was roughly 2% of that of an industrialized country. When the report was compiled, the Arab world translated about 330 books annually, one-fifth of the number that Greece translates. Out of seven world religions, the Arab countries had the lowest freedom score in the late 1990s in the rankings of Freedom House. At the dawn of the 21st century, the Arab world had more than 60 million illiterate adults, the majority of whom were women. Yemen could be the first country in the world to run out of water within 10 years. So again, those are some very daunting statistics. And one wonders how anybody in Egypt is going to address those enormous and long-standing social injustices and imbalances. Personally, I don't see a way that's going to happen. I hope I'm wrong. I hope everything works out great. I'd love to see the youthful idealism of the folks in Tahrir Square made manifest in a genuinely just, democratic with a small d Egyptian society. But I'll tell you, anybody who wants to put something like that together is going to have their work cut out for them. One of the things that makes me so pessimistic about the ability of genuine democracy with a small d to survive in the face of fascism is that I think the weight is generally is in favor of fascism. Not only is fascism a philosophy that is embraced by the very powerful, the corporations and related interests that spawned World War II and the forces that precipitated it did not go away, and they're hard at work. Plus, just plain and simple, I've come to believe that evil is more powerful than good. It's easier to throw a brick through a window than it is to make glass. And the people who want to make glass in Egypt are going to have their work cut out for them. And I think with the pro-corporatist free market ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood, something near and dear to the transnational corporate community, I think that the glassblowers will, the glassmakers in Egypt are likely to be overthrown or subsumed by the brick throwers. The Financial Times of March 18th of 2011 had a pessimistic outlook upon the eve of some of the first elections in Egypt. This is an article by Heba Saleh. It's headlined, "Constitutional Changes Set to Propel Brotherhood to Power." This, by the way, is exactly what we were told wasn't going to happen initially. Now the Muslim Brotherhood is just laying back. They're not going to seize the revolt. Actually, I think the evidence suggests that they were planning to co-opt the uprising. In any event, check out the following. "Constitutional Changes Set to Propel Brotherhood to Power." Divisions emerge between Islamists and secular groups over rapid transition to democracy. This article reads in part as follows. The Muslim Brotherhood, the Egyptian opposition group long repressed by the ousted regime of Hosni Mubarak, looks poised to emerge as the main beneficiary of new political arrangements to be put in place by Egypt's transitional military authorities. Skipping down. Some analysts and political activists said the Supreme Military Council, which is ruling the country during a short transition, may have decided that an alliance of conservative forces presents a better option for the future than that offered by the young secular groups. There are signs the military may have decided to bet on the Brotherhood as the biggest organized force on the street, said Hossam Tamam, an analyst who specializes in Islamist groups. Again quoting, "The other small parties and secular groups may be seen by the army as representing an unwanted and radical transition to democracy, unquote. Shadi al-Ghazali Harb, a member of the coalition of youth groups that led the protest, said he had, quote, strong suspicions, unquote, that such a mindset might exist. Skipping down again, the Brotherhood is the only political group to have been represented on the panel of experts handpicked by the military that drafted the constitutional changes. One more time, because this is critical. The Brotherhood is the only political group to have been represented on the panel of legal experts handpicked by the military that drafted the constitutional changes. A range of opposition and legal experts has criticized those amendments as an attempt to patch up, unquote, Mr. Mubarak's constitution in ways that could threaten democracy and lead to a botched transition, quote. There has to be a completely new constitution, unquote, Mr. Harb said, again quoting, we need a constituent assembly to draft a new constitution, and we need a longer transition with parliamentary elections after a year. The proposed changes meet some long-standing demands of the opposition, such as limiting presidential terms to 4 years, renewable only once, Mr. Mubarak ruled for 30 years, and lifting restrictions that, in effect, barred independent presidential candidates. But a new article requires Parliament to elect a committee of 100 members to draft a new constitution. That means, critics say, that forging Egypt's political system will be in the hands of the Muslim Brotherhood and the NDP. Tahani El-Gabali, a senior judge in the Constitutional Court, described the article as, quote, catastrophic, unquote, and said that it threatened the, quote, revolution itself and the future of Egyptians, unquote. Well, that was on the eve of this referendum. Agence France-Presse had the following, this from March 21st. After the referendum, it's by Jailan Zayan of the Agence France-Presse, and it's Dateline Cairo headlined, Fears Egypt Vote to Benefit Islamists, and it reads in part, Egypt's first exercise in democracy in decades was hailed as a success on Monday, but the result of a key referendum has raised fears in some quarters that Islamists will hijack looming elections. Egyptians on Saturday voted 77% in favor of proposed constitutional amendments intended to guide the Arab world's most populous nation through new presidential and parliamentary elections within 6 months. The Muslim Brotherhood, through its huge influence and grassroots organization, behind a yes vote, although youth groups that spearheaded the protests that forced Hosni Mubarak to resign last month had called for a no vote. They argued the timetable set by the military was too tight for them to organize at the grassroots level, that the Muslim Brotherhood would benefit, and that the changes to the Mubarak-era constitution were too limited. In an editorial, the mass circulation daily Al-Ahram said the referendum was, quote, a win for democracy, unquote, a view echoed by the state-owned Al-Ghamouria, which said, again quoting, everybody has won in this referendum, whether they voted yes or no, unquote. The Coalition of the Revolution's Youth urged supporters not to feel defeated after the result and called on everyone to respect the result of the historic democratic process, unquote, and quickly begin work on the next phase, quote, we are now on the doorstep of a new era in which Egyptians will shape their state for decades to come. We must work to carry on fulfilling the ambitions of the revolution, the group said on its Facebook page. But others felt more threatened by the result. That, again, right after the election from Agence France-Presse. From the conservative Wall Street Journal, we have the following assessment of the Egyptian elections. This by Matt Bradley of the Wall Street Journal. This is from the Journal of March 22nd, the day after that Agence France-Presse article. It reads in part, it's headlined, by the way, Egypt Vote Shows Islamist Influence, and it reads in part, Egyptians' embrace of a set of proposed constitutional amendments in this weekend's referendum is the clearest sign yet that the leadership of the country's revolution may be passing from youthful activists to Islamist religious leaders, according to analysts. Electoral officials said 77% of Egyptians voted to accept a set of proposed amendments to Egypt's constitution that will, among other things, limit the presidency to 2 4-year terms, and ease restrictions on independent political participation, according to results announced Sunday. The proposed changes were opposed by protest leaders and by presidential frontrunners Mohammed el-Baradei and Amr Moussa. Both men urged Egyptians to reject the amendments written by lawyers and judges dominated by Egypt's military, parenthetically, the Muslim Brotherhood in particular. Protest leaders and opposition politicians instead pushed for an entirely new constitution that would further limit expansive presidential powers. The results from Saturday's referendum signaled a shift in Egypt's continuing revolution. The protest leaders, once celebrated as heroes and martyrs, are no longer the leading voices in Egypt's transition to democracy. In their place are popular religious leaders whose strong backing of the amendments held sway. These leaders see approval of the amendments as an avenue to political power and a means of preserving the country's Islamic identity. With their influence in what appear to be Egypt's first free and fair elections, these political playmakers show how they are positioned to help define Egypt's democratic future. The powerful Muslim Brotherhood, a once illegal Islamist political group, was joined in supporting the amendments by leaders of the Salafi Islamist movement, which follows the ultra-conservative brand of Islam widely practiced in Saudi Arabia, and residual elements of the former ruling National Democratic Party, or NDP. Opponents of the amendments, which included many in the youth movement, said the Muslim Brotherhood allied with the NDP as part of a cynical power grab. The amendment's approval has set the stage for parliamentary elections this summer, for which only the Muslim Brotherhood and the NDP of Hosni Mubarak have the organizational structures to compete. Skipping down. This is a nightmare for intellectual Egyptians, said Nabil Abdel Fattah, a political analyst for the Al Aram Center for Political and Strategic Studies, a government-funded think tank based in Cairo. Again, quoting, all the youth accepted the results of the referendum as a form of democracy, but at the same time, they felt very deceived by the dangerous role the religious groups played against them, unquote, Mr. Abdel Fattah said. Again, quoting, they felt that their revolution is being aborted and that there is a huge, huge threat to the unity of the country from religious campaigns, unquote. The youth-led campaigns against the amendments revealed the limits of the protest leaders' mass appeal among Egypt's largely impoverished and largely undereducated population. And indeed, we're going to see what happens, but let him eat fascism, let him eat Jews, let him eat Israel, I suspect will be the scapegoating process when the Muslim Brotherhood proves incapable of correcting the enormous grinding and long-standing social problems of Egypt and other Arab and Muslim countries. We just heard an assessment of the political status quo, the first electoral results in Egypt from the conservative Wall Street Journal, the liberal New York Times, actually the CIA's number one propaganda asset and an institution whose op-ed pages have been utilized in really in successive days in February. Muslim Brotherhood leaders were allowed to simply lie in their teeth, and we're going to come back to that inside, too, about the Muslim Brotherhood's history and outlook. But let's assess the following. This from the New York Times, assessment of the emerging political landscape in Egypt. From the New York Times of March 24th of 2011, the following article by Michael Slackman, Dateline Cairo, headlined, Islamist Group is Rising Force in a New Egypt. It reads in part, in post-revolutionary Egypt where hope and confusion collide in the daily struggle to build a new nation, religion has emerged as a powerful political force following an uprising that was based on secular ideals. The Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamist group once banned by the state, is at the forefront, transformed into a tacit partner with the military government that many fear will thwart fundamental changes. It is also clear that the young, educated secular activists who initially propelled the non-ideological revolution are no longer the driving political force, at least not at the moment. As the best organized and most extensive opposition movement in Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood was expected to have an edge in the contest for influence. But what surprises many is its link to a military that vilified it. Quote, there is evidence the Brotherhood struck some kind of a deal with the military early on, unquote, said Elijah Zarwan, a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group. Again, quoting, it makes sense if you are the military. You want stability and people off the street. Does this sound like fascism, folks? Have I been warning about this? I mean, excuse me if this sounds a little over the top. There is evidence the Brotherhood, again quoting, there is evidence the Brotherhood struck some kind of a deal with the military early on, unquote, said Elijah Zarwan, a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group. It makes sense if you're the military. You want stability and you want people off the street. The Brotherhood is one address where you can go to get 100,000 people off the street, unquote. There is a battle consuming Egypt about the direction of its revolution, and the military council that is now running the country is sending contradictory signals. On Wednesday, the council endorsed a plan to outlaw demonstrations and sit-ins. Then, a few hours later, the public prosecutor announced that the former interior minister and other security officials would be charged in the killings of hundreds during the protests. Egyptians are searching for signs of clarity in such declarations, hoping to discern the direction of a state led by a secretive military council brought to power by a revolution based on demands for democracy, rule of law, and an end to corruption. We are all worried, said Amr Koura, 55, a television producer, reflecting the opinions of the secular minority. Quote, the young people have no control of the revolution anymore. It was evident in the last few weeks when you saw a lot of bearded people taking charge. The youth are gone, unquote, skipping down. When the new prime minister, Hashem Sharaf, addressed the crowd in Tahrir Square this month, Mohammed El-Bataghi, a prominent Brotherhood member, stood by his side. A Brotherhood member was also appointed to the committee that drafted amendments to the Constitution. But the most obvious and consequential example was the recent referendum on the amendments in the nation's first post-Mubarak balloting. The amendments essentially call for speeding up the election process so that parliamentary contests can be held before September, followed soon after by a presidential race. That expedited calendar is seen as giving an advantage to the Brotherhood and to the remnants of Mr. Mubarak's National Democratic Party, which have established national networks. The next parliament will oversee drafting a new constitution. Before the vote, Essam El-Arian, a Brotherhood leader and spokesman, appeared on a popular television show, The Reality, arguing for the government's position in favor of the proposal. With a record turnout, the vote was hailed as a success, but the Yes campaign was based largely on a religious appeal. Voters were warned that if they did not approve the amendments, Egypt would become a secular state. The problem is that our country will be without a religion, read a flyer distributed in Cairo by a group calling itself the Egyptian Revolution Society. This means that the call to the prayer will not be heard anymore. Like in the case of Switzerland, women will be banned from wearing the hijab, like in the case of France, unquote, it said, referring to the Muslim headscarf. And there will be laws that allow men to get married to men and women to get married to women, like in the case of America. A banner hung by the Muslim Brotherhood in a square in Alexandria instructed voters that it was their religious duty, unquote, to vote, quote, yes on the amendments. In the end, 77.2% of those who voted said yes. And we're going to continue with this article in side two of this program. We're going to review some of the key points and also finish with a reading of it. We're also going to come back to this, and we're going to jump back in time, and we're going to listen to some of the actual words of Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, when we dip back into the book Cairo to Damascus from John Roy Carlson. However, this concludes side one of For the Record program number 738, Turkish Taffy, part two. This program is being recorded on April 3rd of the year 2011. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.